Des? This is David Crippen of the Edsel B. Ford Design History Center of the Edison Institute in Dearborn, Michigan. Today we are in New York City, in Lower Manhattan, specifically on 95 Madison Avenue, and we're in the conference room of the Walter Dorwin Teague Associates design firm. Walter Dorwin Teague Associates is a venerable institution, but is still very modern and forward-looking, and has probably risen to the top of the industrial design firms in the country, and indeed the world. We are fortunate to have with us today three gentlemen and a lady who have been with the company in executive capacities for many years. And they've agreed to have a sort of free-form discussion on the history of the Walter Dorwin Teague Associates company and Mr. Teague himself, and of course, and how the company, Mr. Teague and the company and its growth and its many projects impacted on their own careers. So if I may, starting counterclockwise, if I may ask each individual to introduce himself and spell his last name and what his position is with the company.
My name is Edward F. Kibble. I've been with the organization since 1936. I started here as a clerk in the drafting room, directly under the head of the design group. We started in my first location was at 210 Madison Avenue, where I honestly believe the company was founded by Mr. Ting.
My name is Frank Del Judas, chairman of Walter Dorwin Teague Associates. I started with the organization in 1938 at 210 Madison Avenue as an apprentice designer in graphics, and learned the trade of industrial design, eventually the profession of industrial design, under Walter Dorwin Teague directly. And this all took place at 210 Madison Avenue.
My name is Aileen Gaughan, spelling A-I-L-E-E-N-G-A-U-G-H-A-N. I joined Walter Dorwin Teague Associates in 1953 when they were located at 444 Madison Avenue. I started in the engineering department, and I went on to the accounting department and then into executive secretary.
My name is Nicholas Politis, N-I-C-H-O-L-A-S-P-O-L-I-T-E-S. I've been associated with Walter Dorwin Teague Associates since 1974. My role is as a consultant in communications and related matters. I joined, I became associated with the firm in 1974.
What's your background?
My background is as an editor, a writer, and a consultant.
I think it would be helpful if we could just decide among yourselves who should take the first whack at company history. Why don't we start with the seniors?
Well, I, by the way, I forgot to spell my name, so I better do it now. It's Frank, capital D-E-L, capital G-I-U-D-I-C-E.
What was your first recollection first off, Mr. Del Judas. Del Judas, what was your background, and briefly, and how did you get into the design field?
Well, I went to Pratt Institute and took a commercial art course. I graduated from Pratt in 1938, at which time Pratt was having its 50th anniversary show, art show, at the at Radio City, one of the buildings in Radio City, and Mr. Teague happened to have his youngest son attending Pratt in the School of Architecture at the time. I believe he was a freshman. The son dragged his father over to the show, and his father was relatively impressed with what he had seen at the show, and I happened to have two or three pieces in the show. The organization was very busy at the time doing five buildings at the World's Fair, and they called into Pratt Institute and asked for two or three candidates who knew something about drafting. And I had some drafting experience from high school, my high school draft mechanical drawing courses, and came on three interviews and was eventually hired by Mr. John D. Brophy. Another person who was very influential in my life, as well as the life of Mr. Kibble, who will participate in this discussion. And I never did meet Mr. Teague. Mr. Brophy hired me, but Mr. Teague did see my portfolio.
Mr. Brophy, one of the officers?
He was the office manager of the organization at the time. But the chief draftsman, Mr. Colby, saw my portfolio and apparently agreed with what he saw. And then
what sort of sketches did you submit?
Well, it was a series of variations of many of the different courses that I took at Pratt: lettering, rendering, life drawing, costume figure drawing, interior design sketches, and many of the other commercially related art courses.
Did Pratt have an industrial design curriculum at that time?
Pratt had an industrial design curriculum at that time, but I was not aware of it, because my encouragement came from a man who worked for the Federal Advertising Agency. He was an assistant art director, and he encouraged me to go to art school and go to Pratt, and I was directed toward commercial art.
I wonder if we could leave it there. Yes. And we'll get back to your career. Mr. Kibble, could you begin sort of at the beginning, as it were, and give us a brief overview of how it all began and what happened? Your association with the TIG organization, plus your beginnings in design.
No, I was a Depression baby. Mm-hmm. And when I got out of high school,
by the way?
1936.
Where was that?
In New York City.
Yeah.
My father said that, unfortunately, my brother and I were very close in age, and that he could not afford to send us both to college, but that if we went out and worked, he would do everything to help support that going to college. I applied for a job at Walter Dorn Tigg Associates with the proviso that I would have time off during the day to go to school if it became necessary. Mr. Brophy agreed to that, and I started my college education. I had 3 years in architecture, and I began to lean very heavily towards the business aspects of Walter Dorn Tigg Associates.
In architecture at
NYU, New York University. And I spoke with Mr. Brophy, who decided that maybe I should speak to Mr. Teague. Mr. Teague never saw my work as an architect, but I did work directly with two or three people in the organization. One was Robert J. Harper, who was Mr. Teague's right-hand man for many years.
Harper?
The Robert J. Harper, yes.
Was it Harper? Or
Harper, H-A-R-P-E-R. They had both Mr. Harper and Charlie Colby, that Mr. Del Judas spoke about, encouraged me to stay in architecture. But after talking to Mr. Teague, who had a different idea of what he wanted me to do in the organization, he wanted me to understudy Mr. Brophy, who was his business manager. Highly influenced by Mr. Teague, because I did admire him very much, I, at the last year, changed my course at NYU and got my degree in management and industrial relations. I graduated on Monday night and went into the service in 1941. I enlisted in the service, and I was out of the organization for about 5 years. I was in overseas, and it was during, that was before the war, before the United States got in the war. When I came back, Mr. Teague coaxed me into coming back because I had decided to go into the, I was a lieutenant colonel in the Air Force, and had decided to stay overseas in the Army of Occupation. But at a Christmas party, while I was still in uniform, Mr. Teague told me that I was very foolish and that there was a career here at Walter Dorn Teague Associates for me, or then it was just Walter Dorn Teague, and I came back. I took a leave of absence from the service, and I came back to Walter Dorn Teague Associates.
Mr. Judas, if you could move forward in time to, from your earliest association with the company, give us an idea of how the, what the atmosphere was in the office, what kind of products Mr. T was bringing into the firm, product design commissions, how the design setup worked, how you related to it, how you evolved, matured.
Well, Mr. Teague brought in a variety of assignments from his clients, both new and existing clients, and they varied from simple graphic spot designs and lettering to typographic layouts for such magazines as Business Week and other Aviation Week and other McGraw-Hill publications, to exhibits for the Ford Motor Company at the Astor and for United States Steel. And then when the war broke out, he concentrated on developing a relationship with the then Bureau of Ordnance of the United States Navy. And we were heavily involved during the war in ordnance support design for the Navy, and that was a highly technical area. And I was not trained as an engineer, but we did have a group of Darwin had left the company by then, but we did have an engineering capability in the form of Robert Ensign, who eventually became a partner, and Gordon Peltz, who was a graduate engineer and a relatively large individual, to a whole floor of engineering and engineering illustrators to support some highly secret, at that time highly secret work for the United States Navy and firepower and fire direction firepower from battleships, etc. And toward the end of the war, we began to get some commercial work from the Schaefer Pen Company, from the Schaefer Brewing Company, from, I guess we did get a little bit of work from Ford, and in 1946, we got a he had an interview. When I say we, I'm used to speaking in that term, in those terms, but he had an interview with some executives, an executive, Mr. Wellwood Beale of the Boeing Airplane Company, to do some interior design work for the Stratocruiser, which was in the process of being developed. And I was sent out to Seattle for a three-month assignment, and I never came back. So what happened back here between 1946 and 1956 is kind of up to Mr. Kibble to fill you in, but I can tell you all you want to know about what happened out there. But I can't, if I can remember it.
I'm sure. God bless you. It comes back to you very easily. Perhaps between you could give us sort of a feeling for the late 30s and early 40s, the world of industrial design as you saw it from the Teague office. Obviously, it was just in its infancy, at least a decade earlier, about a decade old, I would say. And there were some real giants, Mr. Teague, Mr. Dreyfus, Mr. Destin, and others who were coming up with what turned out to be milestone designs. Did any of that permeate the office structure? Did you get a feeling that talking with Mr. Teague, or perhaps conferring with him, or consulting with him, that you were, in a sense, making industrial design history?
I told at the stockholders meeting yesterday
a
story that most of them felt that it should have been recorded. And I think it is what went on in this office in the late 20s and 30s, early 30s and late 30s. In 1926, Mr. Teague had been handling a few industrial design projects. But before that, he was a very successful illustrator, highly in demand. But as he told me in a conversation we had one evening after work, he was not satisfied himself. He was not satisfied. He was not feeling the joy of work. It became a more or less of a burden. And he had made his decision that the best thing to do was to take a few months off, go to Europe, paint, and think about the rest of his life. And at that, during that time, he did that. And while he was there, he made up his decision that he would not do another famous Teague Boarder, and that he would devote the rest of his life to industrial design. And he came back and had a few accounts, like the Eastman Kodak Company, and he did some work for them.
The famous, was that the, what resulted in the famous camera?
Yeah, the Brownie camera, yes, the baby Brownie camera. And he then made some strong suggestions to them on their fair work. They were having problems with a few of the fairs that they had entered. They felt that they weren't drawing the crowds. And they asked Mr. Teague to go out to the Chicago World's Fair and to look at it and make suggestions. Well, the fair was open, the building was up. Well, Mr. Teague went out, and as he said, on the back of an envelope, walking with the executives of the company, he made drastic changes in the color, some of the structure, some of the exhibits. And the fair the next year was a huge success. And then the word got out that what Mr. Teague had accomplished for Eastman Kodak, and the Ford company came to Mr. Teague and asked for his help. That, when Mr. Teague started, he had only one person in the office that he left here when he went out to the different locations. And in 1934, he hired Mr. Brophy, who became his financial advisor and his office manager. And then we hired a man by the name of John Morse. And Mr. Morse took over the drafting room, which consisted of himself. And from that, they started to build a staff.
So M-O-R-S-E?
M-O-S-E-S.
M-O-S-E-S.
Yeah. In 1936, Mr. Morse left, and Charles Colby was made the head of the drafting room, and we started to hire a number of people. Mr. Teague was then elected to be on the Board of Design of the New York World's Fair. He was the only industrial designer on that board, which consisted of Robert Grover Whalen, who was the head of it. And Mr. Teague and the Board of Design passed on all the buildings that and exhibits that were going into that fair. At that time, we started to build the staff. And as we build the staff, not only for the design work, we begin to get assignments in other products for a variety of clients. Our records, which we keep up on the design assignments for every year, showed that in 1926, we had about 12 or 13 major accounts.
The work with Kodak was really groundbreaking, was it not?
Yeah.
In retrospect, it seemed like he sort of took the world of amateur picture taking out of the dark ages.
Yes. The company was worried about the influx of the Japanese camera. Of course, the Germans had been in the camera business for many years. And what he did, he looked at not only the cameras, but he looked at the company itself, made many suggestions on the film boxing, the packaging of the film. And then they asked him to look at the camera. They wanted to produce a mass
marketing
camera, and one that would have a popular appeal, and one that people would, small enough so that a person could put it in their pocket and put it in their purse and caught just all over. And he gave Mr. Teague designed for the Eastman Kodak Company the famous Brownie camera.
And there was the Super Bantam was there that came along there.
Yes, that's right.
That was the 35 millimeter counterpart.
Yeah, that's right. And today that camera is a classic, and we were very lucky we have one copy of it.
Yes.
Yes.
Some of the other major accounts in the mid-30s that you began to bring in.
Well, in 19 at the World's Fair, I think we had the United States Steel Company, mm-hmm. Eastman Kodak, National Cash Register Building.
These were all buildings.
In exhibits too.
Did he do the interior? The exterior?
He influenced
the architect.
Mr. Teague believed that you designed the exhibit and then you you housed it.
Good. So it was the interior, of course, that was the most
important. Yes, and we had the Consolidated Edison building, which was a major exhibit.
Corning Glass, Marshall Field.
Oh yes.
Dresser Industries, Westinghouse. text.
It's a couple, yes.
Stupid.
No.
Just
at the New York World's Fair, we had the United States government building and the Ford, as I said, the Ford building and the Ford Lounge. We also had, during 1936, the Texaco Company, in which we did the, understand, the first standardized service station.
That was really a milestone, wasn't it? The
yes.
That facade and that interior grouping arrangement was really a breath of fresh air in the gasoline service industry, wasn't it?
Yes. The what Texaco was trying to do was get away from the little mar and par service station that it was dirty. Had junk all around it, and the Texaco Company was anxious to have that cleaned up.
And clean restrooms.
And
yes.
Clean restrooms, yeah. and attractive pumps, and it was one of the, it was one of the first. We also had...
A place where both the ladies and the children of the family could...
Yes, that's right, could come. And not just the men's hangout.
Yeah.
And we had the Westinghouse, we did that Westinghouse X-ray.
What did you do for Westinghouse?
An X-ray machine.
Oh, really? Was it a pioneering design?
Yes, it was really slim down and modernized, and was a very good looking piece of equipment. One that a lab or a doctor's office wouldn't be afraid to have. We also did work for the dresser manufacturing company. We did the
What did you do for dresser?
We did the compressor housing, and it was the 600 HB radical engine and compressor unit.
I'm interested in one aspect of that type of design, if I may interrupt for a moment. Mr. Teague was not an engineer,
no.
But he had a great feeling for housing. Did he work actually in the technical aspect of something like the compressor for the dresser industries? Did he work directly with engineers in terms of what the interior function of the device would be?
I think from my his tutelage and my understanding of what he passed on, the primary condition was to understand when you had an engineering problem and when you had an unalterable condition around which you had to work so that you could respond and express the function through that response with the form that went around it. I hope I've made that
yes,
clear.
That's very eloquent. This has always amazed me that industrial design is without prior engineering backgrounds could, in their imagination, come up with a housing which would so beautifully complement what the company was.
Well, there is intelligence in some of in a lot of the design minds and an appreciation for engineering problems,
right.
But the important thing is to recognize the unalterable aspects of it. You're not an engineer. You're not practicing engineering, and therefore, you have to leave certain aspects of engineering up to the experts that understand the problem
mm-hmm.
and understand the function. But there are things that can be moved about in order to make the form more pleasing, and if you can move something from this relative relationship to this relative relationship in order to get something more compact and to change the portion slightly to make it more pleasing, why not do it? It isn't going to cost you any more money to do it, therefore why not do it? But if it destroys the function of the machine by doing it, then you've got another problem. So you have to interact. It's a problem of interaction with the technical mentality.
Apparently, Mr. Teague had mastered that.
He had a fantastic capability to do that, and he had a very high respect for that mentality. He was not. He didn't write it off as being a pain in the butt, while sometimes might be.
Let's focus a bit on Mr. Teague himself, if we may, unless you have something there you want to add.
Well, I think you should add National Cash Register, which was very important, very
yes,
prominent, absolutely a classic.
I'd love to hear about that design. I understand it was a classic. Do you recall any salient details?
Well, that was a little before
excuse me, I'm pretty sure at the end of this table.
Fine. If we can get back to the National Cash Register unit, if I understand what I think I heard when I first came to work for WDTA, they were working on that design. That was a long time ago. They made a survey of cash registers throughout the land, and it was determined from that survey that the cash registers were terribly abused by the merchants in that they covered them and they used them for shelving and they used them for all sorts of resting places for products that they were trying to sell. So
the clutter.
The objective that WDTA achieved was to give this unit some graceful form, maintain the expression of the cash register that was being that had been developed by NCR, but to give it enough form on the top and on the sides to give you the initial impression that this should be something to look at and shouldn't be used as anything but a cash register. And I think they were successful at doing that. But that, I think, is what I remember the philosophy behind that design being.
Kibble, do you have anything to add to that?
No. That was the project design, I understand.
Yeah, but it seemed to me that that design was so clean and so right that I think it lasted for how many years? 20 years? Or even more.
And longer than that, still some of them are being used today.
Some of them are still out.
Now, this is what is so interesting about Mr. Teague's approach, I think, to me, that here is, perhaps it was his background in graphics that gave him a feel for a clean and functional approach to
it. It's a disciplined, classical approach. That was gained through his graphics capability in designing type, which is an expression of the relationship of proportions of strokes to overall dimensions of letter forms. And that's where this whole, all of these things came together in three dimensions from Mr. Teague's work.
This is what's fascinating to me as a layman, that a vision can be translated first into a graphic idea and then into a fully realized model. I've always been fascinated by this process.
Well, the it's a problem that we face today in the requirement for speed to get from point A to point B. minimizes the amount of time that you have to put to do a proper drawing. We have a man here in New York today that with, on this trip, he's a member of the board from the Seattle area, that we're a design office and we should be producing tons and tons of drawings. Well, yeah, there are things about today, the conditions today that prevent you from spending the amount of time and producing these beautiful drawings. But you had to know how to draw, you had to know how to express your thoughts in a drawing in those days more effectively than you have to today, because today a lot of the young people work in models.
Right.
They work in three dimensions,
right.
So they don't have to go through that laborious process of doing a two-dimensional, three-dimensional drawing,
right.
And then going into and then proving it in a model form. They kind of, there's also been a school of design that or a philosophy of design in which the expression of ugly is beautiful, and that's never been right, and it never will be right, but it still happens that ugly is sometimes thought to be beautiful.
Do you
because
think
it's promoted.
Yes. Do you think that Mr. Teague epitomized the clean, right, functional approach? It seems to me that the 30s was a remarkable decade, sometimes called the streamlined decade, sometimes called earlier on the Art Deco decade. It seemed to me that it was a coming out of the ghastly matrix of the Depression. There was a marvelous optimism and feeling in industrial design that I think was epitomized by the Teague approach.
In talking to Mr. Teague, he told me that the New York World's Fair was the hope for the future. He felt, and this was before the fair opened up, that the American people had been through a terrible depression. They were now faced with another catastrophe happening in Europe. And he felt the New York World's Fair, with its visions and hope for the future, would be a strong point for calming the world. He actually believed that beautiful things could solve some of the problems. I remember he said that there was too much Borax furniture being produced in the United States, too many Borax pieces of equipment.
What do you mean by that?
Pedestrian. And he felt that some of the problems of the world that had beauty and the world that appreciated it would be a world at peace. I remember one line from his book when he said, I'm not trying to solve the problems of the world with words. Too many are doing that now, and use also guns. That's not exactly a quote, but that's what he meant. And he actually believed that. But there's one thing that I think Mr. Teague also had some strong points on, Frank, that was on obsolescence.
Well, that's true. I was going to get to that the point you brought up is very good, that the serenity of beauty goes a long way in helping people feel comfortable. And beauty isn't necessarily a room that's totally white, with a carpet that's totally white, with furniture that's totally white, with a lipstick with the cap taken off in the middle of the sofa. That's pretty cold. That's visually effective, but it's a pretty cold place to live. It's like living in a room of mirrors. It's pretty cold. Mr. Teague believed in simplicity, but not to the point, I don't believe, and I'm not sure what I'm saying at this point. He believed in simplicity, but not to the point of
eliminating total decoration.
Did you ever have any conversations with him in later life in which he reminisced about the early days of the firm and what his objectives were and what his ideals were?
No, he never talked to me like he talked to me. I had opportunities for him to do that, but he never talked to me the way he talked to Mr. Kibble, because the relationship was a little bit different. Mr. Kibble was in the administrative end of the business. I was in the design end of the business, and there was still probably a slight wall of competitive. Don't tell them all the secrets. Perhaps.
A need to know structure.
Yes. Perhaps. And we were very close when he came out to Seattle, but he never did talk about that. He did say one thing to me one time when he said, "This business, we've created a monster in industrial design." He held his head.
Let's talk about that in a little while.
I really don't know what he was talking about, but maybe I do now.
That's a very provocative point. Mr. Dick, before you went into the Air Force, how did the firm evolve administratively and structurally? Did you have a hand in that in terms of working out the financial background, the administrative structure of the firm? Was it a classic sort of arrangement that other design firms have, or was it tailored to Mr. Teague's individual personality?
It was tailored to Mr. Teague's individual, and it has now become almost the standard for the industrial design field. Mr. Teague's involvement in almost every aspect of the business, extremely interested in the financial and administrative end of the business. He had a unique ability to put his finger on problem areas, and we were Mr. Brophy, who was his financial advisor, was always marveled at the way Mr. Teague could sift through all the information that was given to him by the accountants and by the salespeople and the administrative people, and put his finger on the heart of the matter. Mr. Teague, I don't believe, had any business training, and that's the reason why he chose Mr. Brophy, who happened to be almost a lifelong friend of his. Mr. Brophy had a way of handling people that was quite different. Mr. Teague had an idea that people could be molded into the image he wanted them to be. And he was pretty successful at it. And he had an idea about the organization the same way, that he would mold it into the way he wanted it to be, regardless of what was happening in the world around him. And he was very successful at it. He built up, I think, a spirit in the organization that not many organizations had. In the days in the 30s and 40s, there was a great movement in the industrial design field. People thought they had to go out and get experience in a lot of organizations doing a lot of things. And Mr. Teague's idea was that we build a hard core, and these people should be generalists. He had a very peculiar way of doing things, and I think Frank will probably tell you the stories. But Mr. Teague was not interested in your background, as what school you went to and what your major was. And all Mr. Teague wanted to know if you were a designer. If you were a designer, you were a designer, you were a designer. And as Frank can tell you, what he would do is get an idea, and he would walk down the middle of the drafting room with this little piece of paper in his hand, And he went over to anyone, regardless of what training they had, and said, I'm thinking about this project, and you had it. And many people came in with, say, graphics background, and very soon were doing problems in product design. I think Mr. Del Judas is an example of that. Maybe I'm telling a story that Frank will want to have edited out. But I think Mr. Del Judas was sent out to Seattle, Washington by Mr. Ting. And I don't think that Frank had been on an airplane much before that. And now Frank is considered one of the leading, if not the leading, airplane interior designers in the world today.
We'll get to that in due time. I'd love to hear about that. What was the physical setup at the firm? Did you have a model shop? Did you have to farm out any of your, or was you pretty much an integrated organization?
We were integrated. Mr. Ting did not approve of hiring freelance designers, and we never did. It became a policy. His idea was to create an organization that had permanent people, people that would someday build the spirit about WDTA. Yes, we did have our own model shop. We were one of the first to have the model shop.
Was it in the same building that 210?
No, it was not, because at that time at 210 was not an office building.
I see.
It was actually an apartment, hotel apartment. And we had maids to clean the place. We didn't have cleaning people. And we had a doorman downstairs who opened the doors for the people.
Did you have a logo?
No, we couldn't have it on the building. But as we grew, we had to take over more and more apartments on that floor. And at one time, we had the whole floor, and we had, I think, 12 bathrooms, which Mr. Brophy immediately made into libraries by putting in and filing. As we grew, we finally realized that we should look for office space. But about that time, the building was sold, and they made the decision for us. And we moved from 210 Madison, that was at that time primarily a residential area.
What year was that?
We moved in 1939. To 444 Madison Avenue. The model shop remained downtown, and 36th Street.
Yeah.
Around
the corner.
Around the corner from 210 Madison. We moved to the building, and then we started to grow, and we had. The office is on 29th floor, and then we had to take what they call the penthouse in that building. It was on the 41st floor, and that was the beginning of the engineering. And we had moved engineering up there. Then we had to take offices on the 23rd floor, and about that time is when Ms. Gorn joined our staff. And he was down there for quite a number of years. In 1951, we moved to 415 Madison Avenue for more and more space.
You just kept growing.
And then we moved from there to 437 Madison Avenue. Mr. Tigger died in the meantime. We were not happy at 437 Madison. It didn't serve our needs. It was very grand. Too grand.
Out of keeping
with the image of the organization. Beautiful offices, but people weren't happy there. It was, the designers felt cramped. So then we moved to 711 Third Avenue, where we were for 10 years. We moved down here, 95 Madison Avenue.
What year?
1985. We've been here just a little over a year.
Is it suitable to your needs, or are you beginning to outgrow it?
I think we are, in many ways. Mm-hmm. But we do have a lease, and we'll stay here for
how many years have you
been? We have about eight and a half years now to go here. And And I think at that time we probably will be ready to look for more.
In the late 30s, what was the administrative setup? You had Mr. Teague, of course, in a sort of a niche all of his own. He was the founder, president, or founder chief.
He used to call himself the managing director.
Good, that's a good phrase.
Yes,
director.
Through 1945, the firm was strictly an entrepreneurial firm. Mr. Teague was the head.
Mm-hmm.
In 1946, I think it was, in a visit with Mr. Teague, my wife, if I can say this, was pregnant. And I fully realized then that if anything happened to Mr. Teague, the firm would be over. I told Mr. Teague that, and he listened and said that he appreciated that, but he didn't think he was ready to leave the firm yet, which I knew. But I did put the seed in his head, I think, and Mr. Brophy always said I did, to look into the
internal structure.
The internal structure, which he did. He formed Walter Dorn Teague Associates, and he took people in as partners. In the very beginning, there was, I think, three or four partners. And then he added to that over a period of years. And then he took what he called associate partners in.
Were these people who had been with the company for many years?
For many years, and as Mr. Teague stated, he felt that they had helped the organization grow to what it was.
Was this a partnership in which you received a salary and then there was a year-end bonus?
That's exactly right. Yes,
divided up
in what Mr. Teague calls shares.
Mm-hmm.
And then as Mr. Teague began to withdraw from the business because of age, he took his shares and gave them to other people in the organization.
These were private management shares.
Yes, that's right. They were not public in any way, no.
Was this a standard procedure, or was that something of his own innovation?
It was his innovation.
Yes, that sounds like it wouldn't be standard procedure.
No.
So he had built, with all of your help, he had built an in-house staff that distressed loyalty and diligence and a feeling for his vision of what industrial design was.
Yes. Mr. T, when I was made a director of personnel, called me in and said he would like to talk about a culture, which he called the Teague culture. I don't know if that's a buzzword now or not.
It's very much. Corporate culture has become very much a buzzword in the last 10 or 12 years.
Yeah, he may well have originated.
I think he did. He told me that when he got on the elevator coming up into the office, he wanted to be able to pick out the two people. And that was a little hard to realize at that time what he meant.
Not the round people.
No. I don't think he was talking about that.
What was the phrase again?
I'd be able to pick out the two people.
Okay.
And over the period of time, he talked to me a number of times about that. One of the things he said that he wanted me to do, and I've used it when I talk to people about joining the WDTA, I would like you to pick people who are willing to become members of a team, but to put themselves into a position where they can take on greater responsibility at a later date. And that has been the background of our hiring policy.
Interesting to note that attitude was the elder Henry Ford's attitude as well. He always wanted to promote from within. He wanted to develop the members of the staff rather than to hire outside consultants. He hated degrees. He didn't like people wearing their Phi Beta Kappa keys off their watch bubble. He wanted people who could produce. Not pontificate.
No.
It's very close to Mr. Teague's
response. If over the period of years with Mr. Ting, was unhappy with someone, he would suggest that Mr. Brophy, that I would talk to them and tell them the Ting philosophy. When he felt that somebody, as he said, was getting a little big, too big for their britches, would do take him into your office and tell him what we expected, to remind them of why they were hired, and sort of deflate their ego. But Frank has used it, and I have used it too, is that he said one time to me, I think we ought to break every damn mirror in the organization to inflate some of these egos. Some of these fellas can't pass the mirror without stopping and admiring themselves.
What was the Ting philosophy? Can you, in terms of, in personnel terms, how did he verbalize that to you? Or how did you verbalize that to a recalcitrant employee?
Well, I think the first one that we could tell him with the statement I made before about Mr. Ting's feeling. Mr. Ting wanted to emphasize that we were hiring people for what he considered a long term. He didn't think that we wanted people who would come in and jump out. In our business, that is unfortunate, because in the middle of an assignment, to lose a valuable man could be devastating, not even as far as WDTA was concerned, but to our clients. He always felt that there was a responsibility to WDTA, but there was also a responsibility to our clients. Mr. Ting was very organized. His trips to Eastwood Kodak, which he did every month, were obligations that he felt very keenly about, and he made them.
Was this, something just occurred to me, what you said, was this association a long-term association, an ongoing association?
Yes, it was.
Did they retain the firm as a consultant for years?
I would say that they retained Mr. Teague in the beginning,
right,
and then as the associates came into play, he hired the firm.
Mm-hmm.
But it was Mr. Teague's visits up there.
Right.
Frank could probably tell you a little bit more about the arrangement, but what he did was actually to establish a design group within the Eastman Kodak.
Ah.
And then he went up every month. He would review what they were doing, and where there was an assignment which he felt could best be handled back in New York by his group, and then he would bring it back here. But he did build the internal design section of.
That's interesting. So he would not keep it completely in house. You would execute the commission. You would ride herd on its development, and then for an ongoing phase, you would educate the firm's design.
Well, that's to some extent, yes, that's correct. But in the case of if I may, I'd like to clarify the Eastman Kodak as I understand it.
Yes.
Mr. Teague was retained as an individual by Eastman Kodak, Walter Dolan Teague. Period.
Right.
And he did the original, he did a lot of original design work on his own premises.
I see.
But part of his responsibility, I believe, was to set up an in-house design group for Eastman Kodak. And they would do creative camera work also.
Mm-hmm.
And he would go up there every month and critique this work, and they would critique what he did on assignments that he got from them, and that's the way it is. But as they became more proficient and adept at and more in on the technical aspects of camera production and newspaper sales and all of the marketing expertise. He did less and less, or was required to do less and less physical design and more consultation.
That's the impression I get, that Mr. Teague was a great salesman, probably a consummate salesman, was able to sell, in the best sense of the word, his vision of what the product should be. And it wasn't until later that you began to hire technical people and engineers and master draftsmen and so forth to come up with the actual product.
When I came to the company, there was a room full of draftsmen and a room full of architects and a couple of engineers, if I'm not mistaken, plus renderers, people with rendering capabilities and lettering graphics capabilities. They called it lettering in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But that kind of thing fluctuated in number, but there was always a steady